And welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, an hour on bioethics. This hour, if you have a question about bioethics, it's in part because the field of biology and the insights into biology that scientists and technicians are gaining every day, it presents us with the need for finer and finer ethical and moral distinctions in how to treat disease, in how to treat people with diseases, and how to treat people who are well, as a matter of fact. All those questions are welcome this hour if you have a particular bioethics question, or if you have a more general question about the direction of things or how we Catholics think about bioethics. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I think it's fair to say that around the world, When people have serious questions about bioethics, they turn to the Catholic Church because the Catholic Church has a long and deep intellectual tradition of inquiry into morals, into ethics, and into science, all areas that one would need some familiarity with in order to answer bioethical questions. Among the leaders in the Catholic Church in that regard is Father Tad Poholchik. He's the Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. The National Catholic Bioethics Center answers questions every day from people all around the world about particular bioethical issues and about general bioethics trends. They produce fine work, and we're always delighted to have Father Tad Poholchik with us. Father Tad, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Cy. Great to be able to join you this evening.
I don't think that I'm exaggerated in the introduction when I say that I do think the Catholic Church is taken quite seriously around the world, even by those who maybe don't believe in God, as far as its inquiries into morals and ethics having to do with life and medicine and biology. There's always going to be Catholics at the table wherever these discussions are being had.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think the position of the church is a measured position. It indicates that there's been a lot of reflection around some of these modern issues. And I think sometimes there's this notion that, you know, because people will make statements that science and religion oppose each other, they imagine that church individuals will not have a well-developed or well-reflected on position, and that's not the case at all. I can think of various cases in the past where scientists have gone to a scientific conference or another type of gathering of experts and encountered individuals from the church who, you know, were familiar with their area and realized that in some regards they almost knew more than they themselves did, and they were very impressed to realize that the church has, as you pointed out in the opener, this long tradition of moral reflection, and that this really has very practical implications. I think that the work that we do at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, again, as you sort of emphasized, has a very practical dimension, because at the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road is going to always be questions about what may I do and what should I not do? What must I avoid in order to have a life that is ordered and, you know, centered on God and on truth? And so we deal with a lot of very practical types of questions that come up, questions about whether people should work for a particular pharmaceutical company when in some other branch they're doing some kind of ethically troubling research, or what about, you know, getting my dad onto a ventilator? If we put him on, does that mean we can never turn the ventilator off? You know, questions like that, there are just so many of them that come up, and we deal with them. They're all very practical kind of first-person types of questions that I think Catholics need the tools to be able to sometimes deal with it in their own family. And what the church offers here is a very careful reflection on these types of questions and the help of guiding principles as well.
888-318-7884, the number if you'd like to talk with Father Tad Poholchik. You are welcome to do so whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884. I have to say, I have my own sense, Father, is we don't always know until long time later, which are the major historical developments of any time. The things that we think are important often may not turn out to be in the end. But I do think even 100 years from now, the development of gene editing and CRISPR technology, and this is world transforming stuff. And we're just at the very beginning end of it. You have some news there about some of what's going on with this new and really kind of, to me, a little bit scary technology of gene editing.
Yes, I think your assessment is right. 100 years from now, when we look back, definitely this is going to be a pivotal moment when we really got a lot of powerful tools into our own hands that enable us to edit our own genes. Just an amazing thing. And, you know, that editing of genes can be both good and bad. It can be good in the sense that if somebody has a gene defect, it's sometimes going to be possible to fix that defect using these editing tools. But in other cases, it's going to be a problem if you start doing gene editing of little embryos and trying to create humans that have new properties, for example. That's going to raise extremely serious ethical concerns, also because you will be changing future generations of humanity. So it really is an awesome power. So the development that you mentioned that has been in the news recently is another, I would call it a kind of breakthrough. Normally, when you do these gene editing experiments, you can only change the DNA in your chromosomes. But it turns out you have some DNA in another place in your cells also. And that second place is the place where energy gets produced in your cells. It's called mitochondria. They have some small, tiny little pieces of DNA, but those pieces of DNA are super important. And if you have some defects in those, you can get some very serious diseases of the brain and of other parts of the body. So the new development is that normally you could only change your chromosome DNA. They have found a way to go inside your mitochondria, these energy-producing batteries inside your cells, and fix or modify DNA inside the mitochondria. So, you know, this is very beginning, early stage research, but very promising in the sense that if this becomes practical, which it's likely to do, then it'll be possible to change these small pieces of DNA that are in the mitochondria and potentially cure some very serious diseases that children are sometimes born with. So it's something to just keep an eye on, I would say, you know, during the next 5 years or so, as I suspect that technology will catch up to the CRISPR technology and become, you know, widely deployed as well.
I'm so happy to hear that, because this is terrible suffering that comes from these mitochondrial diseases, and often people losing children as a consequence of these diseases. But I can't get over my sense, maybe it is just a feeling, that we're not ready for this, that we are just, when you look around at the condition of the human race, are we ready to be the kind of people that wield this kind of power?
That's a great question, and I would share your reservations, and that's why I'm in the business that I'm in. There's a sense in which it's clear that science has proceeded many times without careful ethical reflection, and yeah. That's always a point of contention and concern. You know, we had a scientist over in China not long ago who announced the birth of some twin baby girls, both of whom had their genes modified. Nobody knew this was going on. It was in his lab, done quietly using in vitro fertilization. And this was announced at a major scientific conference in Hong Kong. And then he was placed under house arrest in China after this became public. And then he went through a trial in China and actually was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment for ethics violations, which was quite surprising. But, you know, it just showed that he was one of these potentially rogue scientists who, you know, he thought this was the right thing to do, to go in and start manipulating the genes of embryos. And he allowed those embryos then to be implanted and babies to be born. And there may have even been a third baby, according to his own reports. We don't know that for sure. And so you're right. It's like, wow, these things are happening, and the ethical discussion seems not to be taking place among the scientists. Although the Catholic Church, you know, has very clear articulations and insights to share, it seems there's a certain ivory tower mentality, and many of the scientists feel that they can just, you know, if the outcome is something desirable, if it's something I want to do that would be scientifically interesting, well, then full speed ahead. Let's just do it and see what comes out the other end. And that's a recipe for a lot of grief and trouble in the future.
Well, I, certainly the rest of us have to stop being intimidated by the kind of patina of scientific purity. That you have to be able to stand up and say to a scientist, just the way you would say to anyone else, that's wrong, you can't do that. And there is a lot of intimidation around, well, then they'll call you anti-science, and they'll say you don't believe in science, or you know, all these things that are designed to just close down a conversation, because I think there's just a large number of people who don't want to have that conversation, that there are ethical implications, there are moral implications, there are indications have to do with basic justice towards our fellow human beings that are being ignored and trampled in many of these instances.
I think that's correct. And many times there is a desire to sort of short-circuit a dialogue. And that's part of, you know, the problem. Another part of the problem is that very often you do have Catholics who will move into, you know, biopharmaceuticals and biotech, take up jobs, and the Catholics themselves are not well formed on these issues. And so we will end up getting, for example, consultations from people who will say, oh, I just discovered that our company is using a cell line that came from an abortion that happened in 1966. And they're developing a vaccine. Is this allowable for me to continue working here? And, you know, then they have these concerns of conscience, and they've never thought these kinds of questions through before. So I think there's, you know, it's a multifaceted, complicated reality as biotechnology expands in our world to have adequate ethical backing present in these environments. And that's why Catholics in particular, I believe, have a critical, critical role to play and really have a duty to make sure that they have, you know, that they're up to date, that they've reflected on these things, they've gotten some formation around the basic ethical issues in the biosciences, and then they will be able to give very effective witness on behalf of, you know, our Lord and His Church, and right in the workplace, they will be that leaven, as it were, that yeast that rises up.
Father Tad Poholchik is our guest. He's the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. There are a ton of folks on the line, and I have made them wait. I apologize for that. I get that way when Father Tad's on. But I promise, directly to the phones when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, our guest, Father Tad Poholchik, and on the line, a whole bunch of folks, so we will go directly to the calls. We'll start with Tim in Broomfield, Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. Tim, your question for Father Tad.
Hi, Father. My question is about contraception, and how can we have a like a good solid argument for somebody who is not Christian to oppose contraception?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, there's kind of a two-pronged possibility here. One is to focus a little bit on some of the potential harms from contraception, because these are things that, you know, anybody can sort of wrap their mind around, and, you know, raising questions along the lines of, is it appropriate to break a perfectly working system in your body? Because, you know, our reproductive systems work well, and what does contraception do? It comes in and it tries to break down that system and prevent it from working. And to ask the question, you know, is that what medicine is supposed to really do, to come in and break a working system? And clearly that's counter to the purposes for which medicine is ordained. So that's one angle that I think one can take, and also to point out then, for example, that, you know, birth control pills comport a great deal of risk in a number of different directions, elevated stroke risks. There are certain types of cancers that have been demonstrated in large population studies to be more prevalent when women are on long-term contraception, et cetera. So I think those points also are points that pretty much anybody can wrap their mind around. But I think the second prong here that can be useful is to, in a sense, initiate a discussion about the purposes of our sexuality. And that's, of course, where non-Christians have made some big mistakes in their understanding. They have not acknowledged with clarity the purposes of human sexuality, and they have slipped into a worldly mindset that has reduced many aspects of human sexuality to merely kind of pleasure-seeking functions, and divorced it from the setting of marital intimacy and married life in general. And married life is, of course, the unique setting in which the incredible gift of our sexuality is meant to be exercised, and always in an openness to life, that we realize the whole meaning of sex is about life itself, that it's about handing on this stellar and unbelievable gift from God that we're allowed to participate in. And so for us to go in there and muck up the machinery with contraception and to, you know, impose our own raw willfulness in these situations to be able to, in a sense, extract the pleasure for ourselves, but not have to take responsibility for the deeper dimensions of the action that we're engaging in. That's a point that, you know, I think is worth bringing out and plumbing, going to the depths of it with our interlocutors who may be non-Christians. So I think that two-pronged approach will, you know, gain you a fair amount of traction, Tim, and I hope that's helpful as an answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate the call. We're talking bioethics this hour with Father Tad Boholcik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Your calls are welcome, whether you're Catholic or not. I mean, if you're struggling with an ethical issue having to do with a family member or a situation, a medical situation, you're welcome to call whether you're Catholic or not. Father is available to give you the very best answer we can provide. 888-318-7884 is the number. Alan in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Alan, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Father Tad.
Yes, sir. Hi, Father Tad. I'm calling from Northern Kentucky, which is Covington.
But, okay.
The question I have is two-part. Well, they both revolve around twins. Conjoined twins, how many souls are there? You know, if there's two heads, just one heart or two heads, two hearts. The second part of the question is, for those twins where one is kind of, there's a condition called TRAP or twin reversed arterial perfusion syndrome, where you have two beings in this, of a sort, but one may be either well-formed or really only partially formed. And they're drawing their circulation from the twin that has an intact heart and fully formed body. And that stressed twin, the one who is donating his heart output, ends up kind of dying, if not dying. And so they both end up dead. So it's like that. And so OBs will ablate the vascular communications or even, you know, the cord to the twin that is not able to perfuse themselves or to pump their heart around. So, you know, is that abortion? What's going on with that? And it's obviously two souls, but what if it's not a fully formed being, like just has a part of a brain and no heart?
Father?
Yeah, Alan, it's a very good question. It's actually a fairly complex question in the sense that conjoined twins present in many different forms. So you alluded to that a little bit in the sense that you can have conjoined twins that may share a heart, or they may have two hearts, each having their own, and their conjoined sections may be very limited. It may be just a small piece of tissue, or it may be some lower organ, like they may share a liver, something like that. So the question, I mean, there are a couple of questions. I think the main point of importance with respect to surgical interventions, which is really what I hear the main drive of your question to be, what may we do, what may we not do, and how can we have a sense that we are not engaging in a direct abortion in some of these complicated situations of conjoined twins. So I think what's important first is to do one's best, and sometimes this is not always possible clinically, to identify each body and which organs appear to belong to which child. Because there will be some cases where you will have one child, as you were implying, who is very much dependent because they are missing their own organs, and they are relying entirely on a set of organs from somebody else. And those cases, in some situations, it'll be possible to do a separation there based on the principle of double effect, where you are removing the other child and tolerating the secondary unintended loss of their life in order to restore functionality to one. But it's important that when you do that, you are operating truly on the body of the first child, and not that you are attacking the body of the second. So it's a genuine separation that you are engaging in. So as you can tell from the way I'm answering this question, it is a complicated, detail-dependent answer that will always be at play. And the same holds for some of the twin-to-twin transfusion syndromes that you referred to in your question, where there's a lot of vasculature that may be shared between the twins, and you have to make some decisions about, can I close down particular blood vessels? Again, it's going to depend on the assessment of, you know, which body and which body parts and which blood vessels belong to which child, and whether or not it will be allowable in some cases to do that, or whether it does, in fact, constitute a direct attack on one of the two twins. So I can only answer your question generally like that and say that we do have a moral duty always to not engage in direct surgical or other types of attacks on patients who present to us. And that applies to conjoined twins as much as it would apply to any other individual who might, you know, come to our clinic.
If I may, Father, what guidance is given to the doctors when they cannot be sure? Is there any help that been given to them? You know, we can't, you know, you say you have to map these things and be very careful about what belongs to who, but in situations of uncertainty, what's the guidance?
I would say that the problem of achieving moral certitude about these questions is important. And if you cannot achieve moral certitude and you have sufficient doubt that you should be taking a particular action, then I think you need to refrain from that action.
I see.
In other words, if you're reasonably convinced that it's going to cause a direct death, then you need to not engage in that intervention.
All right, Father, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more discussion on bioethics with Father Tad Boholczyk.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Where are the seven sacraments found in the Bible? Why do we need the sacraments? Can't God just give me grace directly? How do some sacraments leave a permanent mark on the soul of the person receiving them? 20 Answers the Sacraments explains the mystery of these powerful gifts from God, defends the Catholic understanding and administration of them, and shows you how to receive them with the disposition needed to make the most of their effects. 20 Answers the Sacraments is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team asks, what are food deserts?
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We're joined by Father Tad Boholczyk from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I didn't say this, but Father is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts. Although you don't sound that Massachusetts, Father.
Well, I was born in Boston, but I actually moved out west when I was pretty young, so I didn't acquire the kind of, you know, Boston.
Yeah, I got you. But you're in Philadelphia right now. Isn't the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia, or am I?
Yes, remembering? That's right. And I'm in Philadelphia at the moment.
888-318-7884, the number. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call with your questions on bioethics. We're happy to take your call. Let's go to Mary in College Station, Texas. Hello, Mary. You got a question for Father?
Hi. Yeah. Hi, Father. So I have two parts to a question involving end of life care. My first is, if you could speak to the meaning of excessively burdensome reasons for, you know, refusing medical treatment. If you could just give a few examples of what might constitute, you know, in the patient's, you know, subjective position perspective, what what are some examples of like legitimate reasons to refuse treatment under the, you know, quote unquote, excessively burdensome? And then also, like, what are examples of things, a reason that you might question, say, you know, that's not necessarily excessively burdensome, and then you may have a, may need to have a conversation with that person, you know? So that's the first part. And then the second part, so I'm thinking of non-Catholics who are at the end of life, and, you know, they're, you know, if they don't see the meaning of suffering, and they kind of are just giving up, how would you approach them and, you know, kind of try to give them hope, that that extra boost at the end of life to continue to fight, or even, yeah, if that makes sense. So those are the two parts of my question there.
Okay, well, those are good questions. And I think the matter of determining whether something is excessively burdensome, it is, there are a number of factors that you need to look at, really. I mean, so you have a particular disease, and you go in and you talk with your doctor or your surgeon, and they offer you some options. I mean, one of the things you're going to have to say is, well, you know, is what you're offering me here, does it have a reasonable hope of success? Or is this like a total long shot? Is this a one in a thousand chance that this surgery is going to help me? So, you know, when it's a real long shot like that, we tend to say, well, that may be a disproportionate or heroic intervention, and it's not morally required. Now, you're going to have to ask some other questions, like what are the risks and side effects here? If I do a particular treatment, I don't know, maybe they have some new cancer drug that they want me to start. Is this new cancer drug going to make me, you know, vomit three times a day? Or is it going to have some other, you know, heavy-duty effects? And if it is, then you get into this situation where, you know, the cure is almost worse than the disease, and we would say, okay, well, then you're in a situation where the burdens are very high, it's unduly burdensome, and you could decline that particular cancer treatment. So you've got to have those kinds of details to the best of your ability, and sometimes it'll be the case you'll go to your doctor, he'll give you something, recommend something, and you'll say, yeah, let's try it, and you won't know until you try it whether there are some bad effects that might make you then step away from it and back off and say, no, I can't continue. This treatment regimen is just too much for me to bear. So, you know, those are going to be the kinds of questions. I would say there will be questions also related to occasionally to expense. If somebody has no health insurance and has no other safety net, and some medical professional says, hey, let's do this super expensive surgery, and, you know, the guy has to mortgage his house and none of his kids can go to college, well, then we'd say, look, that's a real serious burden. He's not going to be able to probably do that. And for him to decline that expensive surgery would not be necessarily a problem. Now, you know, there are some judgments that are going to have to be made of a very specific nature because, of course, our lives are a great good and we need to take care of them to the extent that we can. And we have a real duty to make sure that we are good stewards of the gift of human life. So those are some examples. And I think... you know, even when you ask questions about things like doing kidney dialysis, people will say, well, do I have to do it? Or is it too burdensome, too difficult? And I think that's going to vary from person to person. Many times, people will be able to do kidney dialysis without much difficulty. They will incorporate it into their routine. They'll go to the dialysis center. They get hooked up to the tubes, they get their blood cleaned, they go home, and they tolerate it okay or pretty well. And they can do that sometimes for many years. But some other people, it will be different. They'll go to the dialysis center, they'll hook them up, they'll do the dialysis, and they will have some kinds of wild blood pressure fluctuations and maybe even have to call an ambulance. And this happens, you know, more and more frequently. And then they go home after they've been dialyzed and, you know, they're at home for the next 3 days before they have to come back. And they feel wretched all 3 days. The dialysis just does a number on their system. Well, in that case, we might say that the burdens are becoming excessive. And in some of those situations, it may be allowable and reasonable to discontinue the kidney dialysis. But it's always a case by case. You can't make a total general statement that will cover everybody, because each of us, our bodies respond differently, the risks that we run into will be different, etc. So that's kind of how I would answer the first part of your question. I think the second part of your question about how do we explain to others about, well, how to put it, the value, although I don't like to use the word value strongly there, of suffering, but the to understand that suffering has meaning for us as humans, and that meaning is different than for the case of animals. You know, animals, when they suffer a great deal, we say, well, let's put the animal down. And that makes sense because the animal can't do anything in the face of their suffering except sort of recoil and hide in the corner. We as humans can do something very different. We can make the decision to accept our situation in light of the fact that we recognize this is another part of the road that we traverse during our lifetime. And it's one of the steps we take. Most of us do have suffering at different points in our lives. It's not always just at the end. Sometimes in the middle of our lives, we may struggle with mental illness or depression. And, you know, whenever we do have sufferings, I think a lot of us, at least those of us who try to reflect on it and think about it, and not just to keep it at arm's length all the time, which is what many Americans try to do, you know, don't put that in front of me. But if we actually reflect on it, we say, wow, I changed during that time of suffering. And that's one of the few times in my life when I really changed. My view on things changed. My worldview even changed. You know, that's the power of suffering, that it gives us a different perspective. It puts us in touch with our own temporality and our own limitations, our own weaknesses, in a way that a kind of purely worldly perspective never can do. And, you know, when I think even for non-Christians, they can begin to kind of see that if we try to share some of those points with them. Of course, we as Christians believe it goes much deeper. And the fact that our Lord himself chose to suffer adds a whole new depth and dimension to this, that our suffering is redemptive. And I often say to people, well, what does that mean? It's, you know, when you have a mother of a family dying and she's deeply devoted in her faith and she's struggling and suffering, maybe even suffering terribly towards the end of her life, and you say to her, you know, your suffering has meaning. What about your son who's away from the church? You know, can you offer it up for him? And what consolation that brings, and what not just consolation, but effects. You know, our whole church is affected and strengthened by the reality of those who say to the Lord Jesus, yes, I accept this particular path that you have opened up in front of me, Lord. I don't understand it fully, but I'm going to do my very best to accept it as much as I can. So, you know, that's for us Christians a very, very beautiful dimension and angle. And for us to be aware of that, you know, we journey through that every Holy Week and the Holy Week liturgies, that redemptive dimension. So I hope that's helpful, Mary. And, you know, I think it's difficult to talk to non-Christians about these things, but there are a number of entry points potentially into a dialogue like that.
Mary, I hope that that was helpful as well. We'll have to leave it there because we have to take a quick break. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. 888-318-7884, our number. More calls for Father Tad right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest. Father is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and he is the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And when we have the opportunity to have him on, we always seize that opportunity because these are very, very important issues. And it's not exactly a time of clear moral distinctions everywhere on our planet and in our media. So to have someone with us who can make clear moral distinctions, in part because he can make clear scientific distinction as well, it's very, very helpful. And we're glad to have him here. And we probably get one or two more callers in addition to those that are on the line. So if you want to dial, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call and ask your bioethics question, 888-318-7884. We can probably get you in by the top of the hour, depending on how this goes. Catherine in Dallas, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. You are next. Catherine, your question for Father Tad.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Hi, Catherine. We can. Your question, please.
Okay. Just quickly, I was wondering if the Catholic Church has a stance on adopting frozen embryos, not creating them. I know that that is against Catholic teaching, but to adopt them once they've been created and saving them from being frozen for many more years and ultimately dying.
Not only do we have a stance on that, we have several stances on that, which I'm sure Father will review for you. Go ahead, Father.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Catherine, great question. And this is a question that does come up quite a bit. It's, I think, on a lot of people's minds because the fact of the matter is that we have assembly line production of humans as embryos going on in every major city in the United States. And it's just happening with clock-like, you know, regularity. We're producing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these embryos and trapping them in the deep freeze for couples who are seeking out infertility treatments. And this is a situation of terrible, terrible injustice where these children are trapped in the deep freeze through no fault of their own, but because this is an unregulated industry which does whatever it wants in order to make some money. It's a very profitable industry. And so we have a situation now in the United States where we have more than 1 million frozen human embryos in cryopreservation. And people say, you know, is the family that made their own batch of embryos, are they ever going to use them? And sometimes they will. They'll come back and they'll implant them. But many times, if they already got a baby, they'll say, okay, we have enough kids, we're happy with things. And they sort of abandon and forget about their embryos in the deep freeze, their children in the deep freeze. Years pass, and then everybody kind of looks at each other and says, well, now what are we supposed to do? And so your question is it all right to adopt these embryos? In other words, if you had say, a married couple who either did or did not have children already of their own, could they implant a stranger's embryo and gestate it and raise it as if it were their own child? Would this be the same thing as a regular adoption? So this has been addressed partially by the last document that came out of the Vatican, and that document basically issued a series of cautions, and it didn't come outright and say this is always wrong to do, but it said there are a lot of concerns around this. And it said, look, we all understand the motivation here is a good motivation. We're all very troubled by the fact that these embryos are trapped, and we'd all like to see some resolution to this, but that doesn't mean that we can necessarily do a step like this. And, you know, I'll tell you my personal opinion, which is only that. It's only, you know, my personal opinion. I do believe that it's not ever appropriate to do embryo adoption. I believe this involves a kind of violation of the marital covenant of the husband and the wife, that in a sense the woman is becoming pregnant and using her gestational powers not through her husband. So he's kind of, you know, standing on the sidelines, someone else is impregnating her with a stranger's embryo, and her body is being utilized in this way. Granted, the end is desirable. We don't want to see these embryos trapped forever. But I think there's a wrong that is being done here in order to try to undo another wrong. But anyway, that's just my opinion. The church has not gone quite that far yet and stated that. Rather, what the church has said is that in situations where a couple is infertile, they may not use embryo adoption as a way to get around their fertility. That is very clearly stated in the document. What is not clear is whether, if a family already has children of their own, whether this might, in rare cases, somehow be allowable. So the debate, you know, is around that type of question. And, you know, many of the people who do advocate for this will say that this would represent one way of helping a difficult situation. But I think it's also possible to see that there's going to be some problems if we start going down this path. For example, if you run an IVF clinic and you're making embryos yourself, and the question comes up, hey, should we make two or three extra embryos this time around? Oh, I heard there's some groups out there who are willing to adopt them later if they're abandoned. Yeah, let's go ahead and make a few extras. You know, there's that problem. And then this whole thing can go in some very odd directions, I'm afraid. You could start saying, well, if a married couple could do it, would it be possible for a single woman? Or what about if you had, heaven forbid, an order of religious nuns who dedicated themselves to rescuing these? You know, it starts to get very kind of bizarre very quickly when you move this out of the setting of marriage and when you step away from the requirements, really, of the moral law around marital intimacy as the source of new life and even its gestation. So, you know, that's a kind of longer answer to your question. I think at this point, it remains not something that the church has ruled out categorically, but has issued many, has thrown up a yellow light, if you will. It's not yet a bright red light, but I suspect future documents from the Vatican, as they explore and clarify these issues, are likely to, you know, continue to develop and clarify the problems, the moral concerns here, which are significant concerns.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm going to leave it there because I'd like to get a couple more folks on with Father before the end of the hour. Mary in Kansas City, Missouri, listening on 92.9 FM. You are next, Mary. Your question for Father.
The difference between morals and ethics. I signed to a thing at work and said I promise never to be ethical. I'm Catholic. You could, it just means, ethical means to me merely legal or not illegal and socially widely accepted, like abortion is in America. To me,
okay, Father, let's get a clarification on that. With the difference between ethics and morals, and when we're talking about ethics, are we just talking about something legalistic?
Well, I think ethics does connote a little bit more of that, that it's a procedural kind of way that you approach moral issues. So you'll say, you know, we have ethical guidelines kind of language. And in that sense, ethics tends to be more procedural, while morals is sort of drilling down to the deeper questions of truthfulness and right and wrong. So, but the bottom line is still that ethics in its proper sense does include and always has as its point of reference sound morals. So you can't have a genuine ethics if it becomes detached from morals. That's how I would, you know, try to summarize that question.
Thank you, Mary. Let's go to William in Peoria, Illinois. William, your question, please.
Yes, my biology book states that meiosis begins. I'm sorry, that life begins at the after meiosis is over, and I wanted to know why the church doesn't ban abortion after meiosis is over in the womb.
Okay, William, I think the question, it's perhaps requires a little bit of refinement, because you're saying life begins, and you know, let's kind of drill down here for a moment. Life, what do we mean by life? Is sperm alive with human life? Well, sperm are alive. They're not dead. They're living cells. They're not human beings, but they are human life in some form. They are, in fact, the carriers of life between generations. Same with the woman's egg. So the problem of, you know, your question being life begins at a certain point, what we need to do is to refine the question and say, when does a new human being come into existence? That's really the critical question. And once you've recognized that you've crossed that threshold from mere cells that carry human life to a being, a new being that is human, that threshold constitutes the ethical line, and it will never be appropriate to engage in a direct attack against any of those human beings who come into existence by crossing that line. So the issue of that you're asking about is, you know, should we say that a human being begins at the completion of meiosis? And the answer is no, that's not a particularly good point. I know some biology textbooks like to pick that out of a hat. But let's really go right to the beginning. When a sperm makes contact with the surface of an egg cell, there is what we call a massive depolarization event. This means there's a complete change in the electrical charge configuration on that woman's egg. And her egg will allow that one sperm to go inside, and then it'll shut the door so that other ones cannot get in. And from that point forward, you have set in motion an enormous series of biochemical cascades, which include the meiosis later that you're mentioning, that will ultimately lead to an adult taxpayer. That's how I like to put it, to be a little bit facetious almost, but to, you know, make the point that you've started something right there that is sacred, sacrosanct, and, you know, important to our elected officials even. And therefore, you should never violate that being, that human being, who has come into existence at that threshold of the depolarization of the woman's egg by the sperm that creates the new human being. So I hope that's helpful, William. The meiosis is not a particularly important time point. It's one of many biochemical marker points along the way of the development of the adult human. We have many
Thank you, William. Thank you, Father. Father Zad Poholczyk, our guest. You can find him at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You should visit their website. See you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.